Okay.
All right, so here's the chart that we've been looking at. The first half of the book, Leviticus 1 through 17, is showing you how to approach God. And then 18 through 27 is how to live in communion with the God that you now have access to. Can anybody remind us, the original audience of Leviticus, what would they have thought about these instructions in Leviticus? Would they have been bored by them, or would they have been excited? I think they would have been excited, because God comes, he takes up residence in Exodus chapter 40, he's now dwelling with them, and they would want to know how to draw near to him. And that's what the book of Leviticus is doing. So whenever people talk about trying to read the Bible in a year, and we think it's all funny that when we got to Leviticus, we just couldn't keep doing it, blah, 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 we're just not reading it with the kind of love for God's word that we ought to. I know people mean that as a joke sometimes, but we ought to love every part of the Bible. And especially try to think about how the original audience would have considered it. God's given us instructions now on how to draw near to him. And should we be excited to know what those instructions are, that we even have the opportunity to be able to be with him? So, all those things, look forward to how Jesus has done that for us. But we're in this section in chapters 18 through 27 about holy living. And one of the things that God is concerned with is that they would reorient their schedule around God's holy feasts. So they're not the pioneers or the ones that are in charge of their own schedules. God is the one that's in charge of their life now. And we're going to see that as we go through these seven feasts. Just a couple things to help orient ourselves to what we're looking at. This is beginning a new section on holy times. Leviticus 23 through 25 is going to have different kinds of holy times for their calendar. But it's going to have a break in the middle. In chapter 24, it's going to get away from some of the calendar stuff to going back in chapter 25 to some of the holy times that they have. But you've got the Sabbath and the seven Jewish feasts in chapter 23. And then in chapter 25, you've got the Sabbath year, the year of Jubilee, things like that. And Lord willing, in 2 weeks when we meet back together, I'll explain, we'll have some ideas on why these calendar times would have been interrupted with the instructions in chapter 24. But one thing to point out about what we're looking at in this chapter is, if you want to understand a population of people, a country, whatever, you need to know something about their holidays or their holy days. What are some holidays in the United States?
Thanksgiving.
And does that have roots in United States history? Yeah. What else do we have?
Fourth of July.
Does that have roots? Do people in Mexico celebrate the 4th of July? No, like, it's something for us, right? And so whatever people kind of gather up around, the days that they consider to be important, say something about what they cherish from their past and what they hold important in the present. And so this is the holy days that God, these are the holy days that God is dictating for them. And so the purpose of these feasts, whenever we did the Jewish feast class, we talked about three main purposes that God has for these feasts. Number one was to remember God's mighty acts. So, like, he's helping them remember when he delivered them from Egypt, helping them remember their time in the wilderness, for example, and how God provided for them during that whole time. Do we have a tendency to forget things that we need to remember? Like the Lord's Supper every week. Why would God want us to remember every week? Because we would otherwise forget. What does it mean in the Bible to remember? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So it goes beyond just, oh yeah, I remember that we were delivered from Egypt. It's like transforming you in the present. Like, this event that happened in the past has so affected the way that I look at everything that it changes the way that I live right now. What were you going to say? Oh yeah. Just what it means in the Bible to remember. Like, there's passages that say in Ezekiel 16, when the nation of Israel is described as this woman that was cast on the side of the road, and then God passed by her. Have you ever noticed that phrase, that God passed by her, and then he speaks, and then she starts to live? This is a side point, I know, but in Mark 6, when Jesus walks on the water, and it says he meant to pass by them, Have you ever thought about that phrase, pass by, and how the Old Testament uses that phrase? When Moses was on Mount Sinai, God's glory passed by him in Exodus 32. When Elijah was on Mount Carmel, God's glory passed by him at that place. In Ezekiel 16, God passed by the girl that was on the side. The idea of God passing by is that you get a glimpse of his glory. So when Jesus was going to pass by on the water, I think the idea would be that the disciples would have seen him walk and they would have seen something about his glory rather than just freaking out thinking it was a ghost and missing the lesson that they were supposed to see. That's what it means for God to pass by. Anyways, why did I say all of that? Oh yeah, in Ezekiel 16, the reason why they went and they cheated on God is they did not remember where they came from. And so these feast days are supposed to help them remember their heritage, remember that they were helpless, and for the Christian today to remember doesn't mean that I think that before I was ever a Christian I needed a small moral tune-up, but I needed to be transformed. And I never forget that. So these feast days would have helped them remember that it's God that's done the work in their lives. Another reason for these things is to promote national unity. You remember that when Jeroboam, when he has his political power, the first thing he does with it is make golden calves, and he changes the story of the nation. And there's some continuity, but there's some discontinuity, where he says, here are the gods that brought you up out of Egypt, and we don't need to go to Jerusalem anymore. He starts to change the national story, and that's in the context of a division that happens in the nation. Why is it that, like in the United States, for example, there's so much division and fighting? Because people are operating with different stories. And I'm not saying that one is more valid than the other. I'm just making a sociological observation that when people are operating under different background stories that clash and conflict, well, no wonder why we don't have a lot of unity. So when one of the things that God does to create unity for the nation of Israel, he says, these are the days that you remember what I've done for you. And as you do this, you guys are going to rejoice in these things together. You're going to have a shared common story. Which all Christians, by the way, do, right? Jesus died for us. That's our common story. He rose from the dead. That's what binds us together. What if we started to change our story? That, you know, maybe Jesus didn't actually rise from the dead. It was some kind of like figurative thing or whatever. Well, now you're going to start creating divisions. So we have to have the shared story that creates this unity. And then thirdly, all of these things foreshadow Christ. There's one way or another in which all of these things look forward to what Jesus was going to accomplish, what he's done for us. And so one thing that I think is important to bring up, I might put this on the next class PowerPoint. But there's passages like in Isaiah 56, Ezekiel 43, I think, Zechariah chapter 14, where it talks about prophecies of the new covenant and that Christians will engage in the Feast of Booths and Christians will engage in the Sabbath, and Christians will partake of the Passover. So why would we have Old Testament prophecies of New Testament Christians keeping these feasts?
Because there's something in them that we need to recognize and learn from?
Yes. And what could we say that we as Christians keep these feasts today? Is there a sense in which we do?
The Lord's Supper does all of those things.
Yep.
Except for the last one, it looks backward to Christ rather than forward.
Right, right. So recently, well, I guess this is about a year and a half ago now, I was studying with a Messianic Jew, and he said, well, you know, we keep the Sabbath, and the Bible says that you need to keep the Sabbath, and my response to him was, I keep the Sabbath too. But I keep it in its true form, and you're still stuck in the shadows. I keep it in its substance. You know what I mean by that? Who offers true rest? Jesus. All of these feasts, in one way or another, look forward to the completed work of Jesus. And so whenever I talk to Messianic Jews now, if they say, well, you know, we keep the feast, I say, yeah, I keep all the feast days too. But not in the shadow form. I keep it in the substance form. And now, I'll say more about that next week, next time we finish out these classes. Because I think that's an important concept that the New Testament is getting us to see, that Jesus is our Passover lamb, that we do keep the Feast of Booths. We're remembering how God is taking care of us, but we don't keep it in the way that the law said. We keep it in its true form. Does that make sense? All right. Okay, so what we're looking at this morning Verses 1 through 4 give an introduction to the chapter, and then it says some things about the Sabbath. And then verses 5 through 8 talk about Passover and unleavened bread. And then verses 9 through 14 talk about the Feast of First Fruits. And then 15 through 22 talks about the Feast of Pentecost. And there's a lot to say about every one of these. And so I think this is going to fill our time pretty well today. Here's a chart. I've shown this before when we looked at the book of Numbers. But you can see that for these seven feasts, we're looking at the first four. Passover, unleavened bread, first fruits, and then Pentecost. Notice, by the way, first fruits and Pentecost are not the same thing. I'll say more about that in a little bit. But I think I used to confuse the two and think that they were the same, but they're not. But you see that there's three groupings of the feast. There's the spring feast here. All three of these would be done over the course of 7 or 8 days. Then you've got the single day Pentecost. And then in the seventh month, you've got three more feasts. So during the year, it's not like every month there's a feast. It's the first month, the third month, and then the seventh month is when you have them. Any comments or questions on that? All right, let's start out then by looking at chapter 23, verses 1 through 4. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, these are the appointed feasts of the Lord that you shall proclaim as holy convocations. They are my appointed feasts. 6 days shall work be done, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest. A holy convocation, you shall do no work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwelling places. These are the appointed feasts of the Lord, the holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at the time appointed for them." All right. Just introduce this and see in verses 1 and 2 and then in 4, and then we'll come back to verse 3 to see what it says about the Sabbath. But in the first verse, God is telling Moses, speak to the people of Israel. Again, we've pointed this out in the book of Leviticus. It's not just for the Levites. These are for all the people. Now, the chapter ends with Moses having proclaimed this to the people. Look at verse 44. "Thus Moses declared to the people of Israel the appointed feasts of the Lord." So the chapter begins with this call for Moses to tell the people. At the end of the chapter, Moses obeys and tells them everything that they need to do. But what are the descriptions of these days? What words did you guys have in your Bible to describe these holy days? Whatever words you have there.
Sacred.
Yeah, they're sacred. What else?
Convocation.
Yeah, holy convocation. That term is used 19 times in the Old Testament. 11 of them are in this chapter. So what does the word holy convocation mean? Yeah, yeah, good. So there's some kind of togetherness about it. It's like a public call to worship. By the way, the synagogue, we're going to see that the Sabbath was one of the holy convocations. Are there any Old Testament passages explicitly commanding synagogue worship? No. It seems like an expediency that was created during the time of the exile. But was there some biblical precedent that they could point to and go, this is why we do this? It's a holy convocation. We should come together on this day. And the word doesn't just mean a public call to worship. It also means something like a reading, like a public reading. That same word is translated in Nehemiah 8, verse 8 as a reading, when they read the law together. It's a holy convocation. Another definition of it is that it's a rehearsal. So if you look at the lexical range of the word convocation, holy convocation, these are the words that you're going to find. Now, in what sense would these feasts be a rehearsal? Excuse me while I check the computer, but try to think about that question. You guys got any answers? Right. Right. Yeah. So they're having the kind of meal that commemorated like what they actually did when they left Egypt, right? So they're rehearsing their history. Do we do that at the Lord's Supper? Are we rehearsing sort of what Jesus did? And is there some kind of value in rehearsing? When I just went up to Boston a couple months ago, I saw the place where Paul Revere was arrested and all this stuff. And there is like pictures of people who have rehearsed those battles. Like, why do people do things like that? Yeah, so you remember it, right? You don't forget what it is that happened in the past, things like that. So that's what this term Holy Convocation means. Now, another description of the holy days is God calls them my appointed feasts. What's significant about God saying my appointed feasts? Yeah. For what? Oh yeah, that would be like the New Testament kind of, like we're called together. Yeah. What's significant about my holy feasts? Right. So, okay, my birthday is March 11th, the day that coronavirus was declared a national pandemic. My birthday is about me, right? Like that's how people think or whatever. Yeah, because your birthday is 4th of July.
So I finally figured out it was my birthday.
Right. Well, on my birthday, Florian got me chickens. But it was also a confusing day. So when God says these are my appointed feasts, who are these holy convocations all about? Is it about what I get out of it? Hopefully you'll get something out of it because you're going to remember. But what's the primary focus? God is. What God has done, the promises that he's made. And so throughout the chapter, 22 times, you're going to see that they are supposed to bring a sacrifice to the Lord, or they're going to bring something before the Lord, to the Lord, to the Lord, before the Lord. 22 times in the chapter. That kind of sets the tone for what we're looking at in this section. And it also says something about when we gather together and when we take the Lord's Supper. And this is about God. It's not about like me being a consumer or something like that. We should get something out of it. I'm not saying that shouldn't be the case. But we only get something out of it when we put God at the center of it all. That's when we really get something out of it. But not when we start with, the preaching was boring or this was that or what, you know, whatever. I don't know. Okay, anything else you guys want to say just about the introduction to this chapter? Right.
Not just, you can't just say, oh, I think he would like this.
Right.
Because he's already said, it's my feast, that we do it my way.
That's right. Yeah. It's like on my birthday, I want Dairy Queen ice cream cake. I don't want chocolate cake. I don't like it. And so if my wife is going to honor me, she's going to do what I tell her. You know? That's a joke. But there's a point to be made about that. Okay. So in verse 3, it talks about the Sabbath. Now, it's ironic that this chapter, which is going to be detailing the seven feasts of the Jews, begins with this discussion on the Sabbath. The Hebrew word for Sabbath is Shabbat. So if you hear Jews talking about Shabbat, that's what the Hebrew word is. And it means something like intercession, rest, to cease from work, something like that, used 11 times in the chapter. And so they're commanded to cease on the seventh day, which is an imitation of God's rest. This is the only Holy Convocation Day that goes back to one of the Ten Commandments explicitly. And so they're supposed to do that. The contrast of the slavery to what they experienced in Egypt, you want to make something other than God your God, and you're going to be a slave. Like, in a sense, that's going to be very diminishing, not good for you kind of thing. But if you want God to be your master, he's commanding you to rest. So that's kind of a cool thing to see about God there. Now, what are the Mosaic instructions? So the laws within the writings of Moses for the Sabbath. Anybody know what some of them are? Yeah, so there's no ordinary work. What else? No picking up sticks? Yeah, Numbers 15, that guy gets killed for that. Yeah, it's all in all your dwelling places. In Exodus 34:21, no plowing or reaping. We got the don't kindle a fire, don't pick up sticks. So these are the instructions that Moses gives in the law of Moses for this day. Now, how detailed are all of these instructions? Not super detailed. Can you see why? Well, I'll wait to say that point. But I just want to get the context of what the other writings of Moses say about the Sabbath. Now think about this question. Okay, if this chapter is about the seven feasts of the Jews, why begin this chapter with the Sabbath? Why not just go straight to the Passover? What's the relationship between the Sabbath and the feasts? Anybody have any ideas on that? Yes, so, and connected to that, during all of the feasts, there's going to be up to seven extra Sabbath days during the seven feasts. You guys have seen this before, right? Where the first day of Passover is a holy, a high Sabbath. The last day of Passover is also an additional Sabbath. The day of Pentecost, let me show you how this works. Like, go down to, verse 21, when we look at the day of Pentecost. You shall make a proclamation on the same day. You shall hold a holy convocation. You shall do no ordinary work. It is a statute forever in all your dwelling places throughout your generations. So, what day of the week was Pentecost on? Sunday. But what is it called, or what do you have to do in verse 21 on that Sunday? Nothing. It's an extra Sabbath. So you'd have two Sabbaths in a row, right? So, like, for some of the days where, like, Passover is on the 14th day of the month, could that sometimes land on a Saturday? So what about a year where none of the days that have scheduled times land on a Sabbath? You'll have up to seven extra Sabbath days during the year centering around these feast days. Does that make sense? So, like, the first and the last day of unleavened bread is a extra Sabbath, two extra Sabbaths there. The day of Pentecost, trumpets, and the day of atonement, all of those are extra Sabbath days of sorts. And then the first and last day of the Feast of Booths is also a Sabbath day. So if none of those line up on a naturally occurring Saturday, you have seven extra Sabbaths during the year. Does that make sense? Okay. And so that's one connection. It makes sense to start this chapter with instructions about the Sabbath, because the Sabbath's going to be woven into all of these feasts. Now, something else to say about them is that each one of these feasts say something about rest. So, like, the Passover and unleavened bread, rest from Egypt. The Day of Atonement, rest from your sin. The Feast of Booths, rest from your time in the wilderness. All of the feasts, in one way or another, have something to do with this rest that God has given them as they get ready to go into the Promised Land. Does that make sense, too? So, like, this idea of rest and intermission, all of these feasts have something to do with those concepts as well. Any comments or questions on any of that? Yes.
It is a celebration of their rest.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah, so you think that's one of the feasts that's outside of the law of Moses, but it still carries a lot of those same connotations that the other feasts do. So that's a good point. Anything else you guys want to say about that? Let me just enter my password really quick, because other than that, it's still going to take another 40 minutes. All right, let's keep looking. I think there's another thing I wanted to say here. Oh, yeah. In the Old Testament, did the Israelites keep the Sabbaths? No, they didn't. So Jeremiah, Nehemiah, Amos 8, these are passages that sort of make blanket statements about Israel's failure to keep the Sabbath days in the Old Testament. I wanted to get to this. This might explain why the Jews of Jesus' day were so nitpicky about the Sabbath. Because in the Old Testament, they had no concern about it, right? They were eager for the Sabbath day to end in the book of Amos so that they could go buy, sell, and trade and all this sort of thing. So their hearts were never even in the Sabbath whenever they were engaged in keeping the Sabbath. And so in the days of Jesus, whenever Jesus would heal people on the Sabbath day, they had like this really strong reaction to Jesus doing things on the Sabbath day. And they were really nitpicky about it. Where did that come from? Well, one of the big reasons they were sent into exile is because you guys didn't keep the Sabbaths. And you didn't choose, it wasn't just the weekly Sabbath. You guys didn't even really keep the feast days either that had connotations of rest. So, all right, was somebody going to say something? All right, yeah, Cherry? No.
It seemed like you would have been constantly concerned that you were going to overstep or something. So there wasn't really any peace because man had stepped in and interfered with God's plan.
That's right. Yep. And that's why Jesus says man was not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man. Yeah. Sewell?
I guess there's a sense in which all those miracles Jesus wrought on the Sabbath were a rest from a condition
yes.
that had been unfavorable.
That's right. So,
as Lord of the Sabbath, he knew the purpose of the Sabbath.
Yeah, and this is why whenever Jesus was accused of healing people on the Sabbath, well, what better day to do it? Like, you're giving somebody rest from this illness that they have, or from your hand that's been, like, withered. And Cherry?
In one of those, he said, should not this who has been bound by Satan have been loosed on the Sabbath?
In Luke 13, is that the woman that was bent over, I think?
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You see these concepts, and all the feasts are looking forward to these things. All of this is looking forward to Jesus, who gives us Sabbath rest. And all of the feasts have some corollary to some sort of rest that we have. Any comments or any other thing? We're going even slower than I thought. There's just so much to say about this stuff. All right, let's talk about Passover and unleavened bread. Look at verses 5 through 8. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at twilight, is the Lord's Passover. That's all this text says about the first feast, just verse 5. Look at verses 6 through 8 about the second feast. And on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no ordinary work, but you shall present a food offering to the Lord for 7 days. On the seventh day is a holy convocation. You shall do no ordinary work. So two times there, don't do any ordinary work. Okay, let's start out with Passover. How many of you, by the way, were in the Jewish feast class that I did? I know Sewell was. Okay. All right, so most of you weren't. Okay. So, for the Passover, the timing of it, when was it?
Sunday.
Yeah, twilight, what day of the month, what month, what day on the month? First month, 14th day of the month. And so, does anybody know what formerly was the first month of the year for the Jews? What was that?
Nisan.
In Exodus chapter 12, verse 2, before God delivers them, he says, this is now going to be the beginning of years for you. The beginning of the first month now. Prior to this, the seventh month used to be the first month for the Jewish people. So even today, the way that they've got a religious calendar and a yearly calendar, and so the seventh month used to begin that was the first month of the year for them. But then because of their exodus, their whole calendar gets shifted around. You know how like we have a school year and then we have like a year. What was that? Yeah, fiscal year and then a school year. So the Jews have got their religious year, which started with the Passover now. And so this event was so important that it reoriented their calendar. By the way, Jesus' death also reoriented our understanding of world history. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Okay, so that's the timing of it. The instructions are found in Exodus chapter 12. They're supposed to eat the Passover meal. What does the Passover meal consist of? Can anybody remember that?
Roasted lamb.
Yep, lamb.
Yep,
the bitter herbs and the unleavened bread. And then they're supposed to have unleavened bread for another, 7 days after that. And so they sacrifice the lamb. This is the only of the seven feasts that most is similar to the peace offering. Do you remember the peace offering where they got to eat of the sacrifice? Of all the feasts, this is one of the ones that is most like the peace offering because they're actually commanded. I remember one time I was in a Bible class and there were some people in the class that were vegans. It's okay if you want to be a vegan. But they thought that like God commanded veganism. Because in Genesis chapters 1 through 11, before the flood, they were supposed to only eat plants, and so they were trying to go back to the biblical roots and that we should not be eating meat today, and they tried to make that argument from the Bible. And I remember asking a question in the Bible class, did God ever command anybody to eat meat? And they went like this. I said, what about the Passover? They were commanded to eat meat. So, you can be a vegan if you want, but don't try to say that you're more holy because of it. So that's what they're supposed to eat. Who can join the Passover? Anybody remember from Exodus 12? So you got any circumcised slave, and then any stranger or sojourner who is circumcised. So this was something that other people could join if they wanted to. And so what's the meaning of this? They look backwards to their deliverance from Egypt, and then this looks forward to Jesus being the Passover lamb. And so I think we're pretty familiar with the Passover stuff. Anything you guys want to say about that idea? All right, let's talk about the Feast of Unleavened Bread then. So the timing of this is the 15th day, and it lasts 7 days. And so this begins right after the Sabbath day. What are the instructions for this one?
Eat unleavened bread and offering daily.
Yes. So eat no leaven for the whole week. And in Exodus 12:19, anybody who eats leaven is cut off. They're killed. All right. So the meaning of this, why would they, what are they rehearsing in having this unleavened bread? That's right. So would the original bread that they would have eaten when they left Egypt may have had yeast in it, but they just didn't have time to rise? Yeah, maybe. It just didn't have time to rise. So in commemoration, they have bread that doesn't rise as a way of like helping them memorize, like remember how quickly they had to leave. And the fulfillment of this would be that Jesus is the sinless bread from heaven. But this idea of the leaven, if we're supposed to avoid leaven for that week, or they were supposed to avoid it for that week, the New Testament says different things are related to leaven. Anybody know what some of those are? Avoid the leaven of... Yeah, so Luke 12:1, hypocrisy is a leavening effect, where a little bit of it affects everything. So you got hypocrisy, you've got the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. By the way, I just learned recently, they're in the New Testament, there's examples of Pharisees being converted, but did you know that there's no examples of Sadducees being converted? There's not one example of a Sadducee being converted. Yeah, it is Sadducee. Alright, so, and then you've got in Mark 8:15, in the context of that passage, there's Pharisees demanding a sign from heaven. Jesus gets in the boat with the disciples and he says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. And in the context, it's demanding things from God. That's another kind of leavening effect. And then also 1 Corinthians 5:8 talks about malice and evil being leaven. That these are all things that are in the heart, just like the yeast would be inside the bread, that if you let that stew, it's going to affect everything about how you see God. So, forsake those things. Susan?
I remember reading one time, it's like during the last week of Jesus' life, the day that people were supposed to get leaven out of their house, because that was the week of, Passover,
yep.
Was the day he cleansed the temple.
And that's possible.
But,
yep.
They were saying it was probably that. So, that would make sense.
Which fit with some of the Jewish traditions about, like, fathers would hide pieces of bread around the house. And they would like have the kids go on like an Easter egg hunt of sorts, where they were training the kids go throughout the house and get all of this out of there, so that we don't have it in that. So it would be very fitting if Jesus cleansed the temple on that same kind of day. I hadn't thought about that before. All right, anything else you guys want to say about that? Here's a chart that shows the 7 days of unleavened bread. So again, you begin and end with an extra Sabbath day. And you have unleavened bread, a food offering. You do a burnt offering every day of this. The first day, there's a sin offering, but not any other day. But notice this here. There's the Feast of First Fruits that's also taking place during the week of unleavened bread. Now, this is just one of those things that I was not aware of. So you've got in over the course of 8 days, you've got Passover, you've got unleavened bread, but you also have the Feast of First Fruits. It's not Pentecost. Have you guys realized that there is the Feast of First Fruits during the week of unleavened bread? Look at verses 9 through 14. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you and reap its harvest, you shall bring the sheaf of the first fruits of the harvest of the Lord, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord so that you may be accepted. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it." So it's on a Sunday. "And on the day when you wave the wave of the sheaf, you shall offer a male a year old without blemish as a burnt offering to the Lord. And a grain offering with it shall be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, a food offering to the Lord with a pleasing aroma, and a drink offering with it of wine, 1/4 of a hin. And you shall eat neither bread nor grain parched or fresh until the same day, until you have brought the offering of your God. It is a statute forever throughout the generations in your dwellings." So when it says, what verse was it, after the Sabbath in verse 11? So in the context, that's referring to after the Sabbath. Which Sabbath? In the context, it's the Sabbath during the week of unleavened bread. Okay? Okay, yeah, we're going to talk about that.
But the first fruits is a harvest, which would be fall, wouldn't it?
Right. Yes. So here's some things to say. Okay, so similarities between first fruits and Pentecost. Both of them involve first fruit offerings. So verse 10 talks about first fruit offerings. Verse 17, during the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, talks about first fruit offerings. Both of them are obeyed after they enter the promised land. In verse 10, after they enter the land. In verse 16, after they enter the land. Both of them involve wave offerings, so they're going to be waving something before God. Both of them were on a Sunday. In verse 11, you've got this first one that's happening after the Sabbath day. And then in verse 15, the Feast of Pentecost, we all know, takes place on a Sunday. All right, so those are some similarities between Pentecost and first fruits. Can you see why people confuse the two? Now here are some differences. The first fruits during the week of unleavened bread was an offering of barley. During Pentecost, it was wheat. Now, I'll prove that in just a second. For first fruits, it was part of the week of unleavened bread. In Pentecost, it's separate from all the other feasts. In verse 11, they're giving one sheaf. They should wave a sheaf before the Lord. And then on Pentecost, it's two loaves of leaven in verse 17. And then the additional offerings, there's some differences with the additional offerings. Okay, do you guys see that? You see that in verses 9 through 14, it's not talking about Pentecost, but you might think that it is. But starting in verse 15, that's when they talk about Pentecost. So whatever 9 through 14 is talking about, it's different than the Feast of Weeks. Is everybody tracking? Because this is going to build up to some things that I think are pretty cool. Yeah, Pentecost is the Feast of Weeks. What are the other terms for it? Pentecost, Feast of Weeks, where did it go?
Harvest?
Yeah, Harvest. I think it's called that in Exodus somewhere.
23.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's getting in my Bible, says Feast of Weeks.
Yeah, Feast of Weeks, yeah.
So is that 50 days after the first
fruits? It's 50 days after... The
50 days. There's something when Jesus died, and then 50 days.
Yeah, it's 50 days.
The 50 days.
The day after the seventh Sabbath, then you shall present a grain offering. So seven Sabbaths from the day before first fruits, and then add a day, so it's a Sunday.
Because was his resurrection first fruits?
Yes, that's exactly. So that I'm gonna show that in just a second. It's super cool. All right, but we can't really appreciate the things I'm going to show next if we don't see this is the case. Do you guys see this? First fruits is different from Pentecost, even though both of them involve first fruits. But it's a different kind of... So the barley grew first, and then the wheat. How can you have unleavened bread if you haven't had barley that has grown? You need to have barley to grow before you can even have unleavened bread to make. So they had to have had some kind of harvest already for them to even have the unleavened bread for the week. So there's different crops that grow at different times. So you're going to have different first fruits. Even the Feast of Booths, there's going to be a first fruits of sorts for that as well, because there's different things growing at different times of the year. All right? Any comments or questions before I move on? All right. So the first fruits then itself, the one that takes place during the week of unleavened bread, this I think would probably be something like the 16th of the month, because Passover was on the 14th, and then you count a couple days after that, the day after the Sabbath, so it'd probably be the 16th of the month. Barley came before wheat, and Exodus chapter 9, verses 31 to 32 show that. So in this time, this area in the world, barley came first and then wheat later, and so you're going to have a first fruits of the barley, and then you're going to have a first fruit of the wheat. The first fruit of the barley takes place during the week of unleavened bread connected to Passover. Okay. So here's the instructions. They had to bring these first fruits of to God before they could eat of the of that that harvest that they had. So God gets the food first, they get it second. And then where the first fruits went, we've talked about this before, that some of them went to God and some of them went to the priests. But the meaning of this, why give God the first of the harvest? Yeah, he gave it to them, so you're honoring him for having given it to you. What else? Can you imagine being an Israelite, and every time you guys have your first harvest, you're giving it to God? What is that training you to
his land?
Yeah, it's his stuff, right? And so it would be training them in that way. Can you guys? Is there any parallels to first fruits concepts with the conquest? Remember when they,
Jericho.
Yeah, Jericho, everything's supposed to be dedicated to God, and then Achan can't wait. But in the next story, when they defeat Ai, they get to take whatever they want. God comes first, though, even when it comes to the conquest. And so God gets the first of everything. Okay, 1 Corinthians 15:20, this is really, really cool. But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. So Jesus is compared to the first fruits. Okay, so here's, okay. If Passover were on a Friday, which is what is, I think, likely that would have been when it lined up when Jesus died. Leviticus chapter 23, verse 4, in the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at twilight is the Lord's Passover. That actually should be verse 5. So you've got Passover there, the day Jesus dies. And then you've got the Saturday, Leviticus 23, verses 6 and 7. And on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. To the Lord, for 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work. Jesus rests in the tomb on Saturday. And then on Sunday, when they would do a wave offering, where they wave it before God, you've got Jesus, Leviticus 23, verse 11, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord so that he'd be accepted. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. All right, so those are the instructions in Leviticus. Now, import that into what happens to Jesus. Jesus died at twilight on a Friday, and the ninth hour, he cries out. Jesus rests in the tomb on a Saturday, and then on Sunday, he raises up, and he's like the first fruit offering. You see how he's fulfilling the calendar in that way? It's really cool. Any thoughts or comments on that?
I guess that explains on Saturday the women couldn't come and bring spices. And that would have been work.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Any other thoughts or comments on that?
And it's at the end of the Sabbath, it began to dawn toward the first day of the week.
Right.
The resurrection.
Right. All right. I'm probably like acting like a mad scientist right now, but I think that stuff is really cool. All right, so look at verses 15 to 22.
You shall count 7 full weeks from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought a sheaf of the wave offering. That's talking about the first fruits, when you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, right? All right, so this is clearly a different thing. Verse 16, you shall count 50 days to the day after the seventh Sabbath. Then you shall present a grain offering of new grain to the Lord. You shall bring from your dwelling places two loaves of bread to be waved before, made of two-tenths of ephah. They shall be of fine flour. They shall be baked with leaven as first fruits to the Lord. And you shall present with the bread seven lambs a year old without blemish, and one bull from the herd and two rams. They shall be a burnt offering to the Lord with their grain offering and their drink offerings, a food offering with a pleasant aroma to the Lord. And you shall offer one male goat for a sin offering and two male lambs a year old as a sacrifice of peace offering. And the priest shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits as a wave offering before the Lord. With two lambs they shall be holy to the Lord for the priest. And you shall make a proclamation on the same day. You shall hold a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work. It is a statute forever in all your dwelling places throughout your generations. And when you reap of the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edges, nor shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. All right.
So the timing of Pentecost. Seven full weeks from the day after the sheaf offering that we read about during the week of unleavened bread. It's 50 days. Pentecost, I was going to say a pentagram, but that's like I say. What's the building? The Pentagon. The Pentagon is a five-sided thing, but so is a pentagram. So penta means five. So 50 days after the Passover time period. This is on a Sunday. By the way, creation began on a Sunday. Because the first day he said, let there be light. What was the last day of the week? Saturday he rested, so creation began on a Sunday. It's kind of cool. Unlike Passover, where it's the 14th day of the month, or the Day of Atonement, or the Feast of Booths, there's like specific dates given. Here you have to actually do the math, where it's 50 days after, and it's going to be on a Sunday from the Sabbath that was during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Okay. So that's unique about that one. It's also an additional Sabbath. All right, what are the instructions for this day? What are they supposed to give?
Two loaves of bread.
Yes, two loaves of bread with what?
Leaven.
With leaven. Why? And you get into some speculation. It's kind of hard to know for sure what's going on. One possibility is that it represents the two tablets of the law, and I'll explain why that would be the case in just a moment. It also could be foreshadowing Jews and Gentiles being one. These are different ideas that people have had about this. They're supposed to give various animals in verses 18 and 19. They make a proclamation in verse 21, perhaps with trumpets. Maybe they're proclaiming that it's a holy convocation. They make some kind of proclamation, though. And then they're supposed to be supporting the poor and the sojourner in verse 22. So in verse 22, what are they supposed to do?
Not reap the corners.
Yeah, and this is also something that's in the law. But I guess this might have been a period of time during the year where God is especially providing things for those people. The book of Ruth, by the way, is oftentimes read during Passover. The Jews have something called the megalith, and it's like a collection of writings that we have in the Bible, but it's like a thing that they put into one scroll where they pull that scroll out like for special occasions. So that scroll would have like, or it's at least a collection of writings. I don't know if they put it in one scroll, but like for the Passover, they read, or Pentecost, I'm sorry, they read the book of Ruth. And then there's some of the other ones where they read some of the other books of the Bible, but they've like certain books that they especially use for times of the year or whatever. Anyways, okay, I'm not explaining any of that well. All right, so the meaning of all of this, God's people are the first fruits. You've got in Acts chapter 2 this first reaping of Christians, but the New Testament says that God's people, that Christians are like the first fruits of his creation. James 1:18 says that. But think about some connections between Acts chapter 2 and the day of Pentecost. The sound of wind kind of reminds you of winnowing barley. Where would they winnow barley? They'd have to do it up on a hill, and they would throw it up into the air, and then the wind would take the chaff away. So in Acts chapter 2, you've got the sound of the wind, that you got the first harvest of Christians in the Bible in Acts chapter 2, and then you've got this instruction for helping the needy and the sojourner. Isn't that what's happening in Acts chapter 2:44 and chapter 4, where there's not one needy saint among them? So you see all of these instructions for Passover being lived out by these people. Now, there's one thing to say about Jewish tradition that may or may not apply that I think is interesting. By Jewish tradition, the giving of the law was on Pentecost. So they're delivered from Egypt. They travel for 50 days. They get to Mount Sinai. And then when they get to Mount Sinai, what do they receive? The law of God. The two tablets, they're offering two loaves of bread with leaven in it on that day. Possible that that's kind of the idea. And so you've got the giving of the law, and you've got, in Acts chapter 2, the giving of the Spirit on that day. Let's see. Yeah, Acts 2 is 50 days after Passover. So you've got the birth of the nation. When they get to Mount Sinai, you've got the birth of the spiritual nation in Acts chapter 2. We've talked about this before in other classes. But at Mount Sinai, when they receive the law, how many people are killed for worshiping the golden calf? 3,000. In Acts chapter 2, when the Spirit is given, how many people are converted? 3,000. It's like what 2 Corinthians 4 says that, or 3, I think it's chapter 3, where the letter of the law kills, but the Spirit gives life. When the law is given, executions happen. When the Spirit's given in Acts chapter 2, there's 3,000 conversions. Same amount of people that were killed in Exodus 32. So you see the reversals going on here, and you, so there's just a lot of things going on with all that. Do you guys have any comments? Yeah, Sherry?
I was going to say, if you think of Pentecost as being the shadow of the coming of the gospel, it's interesting that in Acts 2, verse 1, it says, when the day of Pentecost was fully come, when it was really here.
It says that in Acts 2?
In the New King James.
Does it really? I never noticed that. Let me see if the ESV. Mine says when the day of Pentecost arrived, they were all together. Yours says it when it had fully come. I need to look at the Greek there and see what's going on. That's interesting. Because it really has fully come now.
Yeah.
All right. Do you guys have any other comments or questions on any of this?
Only that, you know, you're talking, I'm understanding you, Pentecost, and, you know, not fully harvesting you, leaving it for others.
Yeah.
All of the same. When I think of 11, I think of the book of life.
Right. Yeah, and sometimes leaven in the Bible is used in a positive sense, and sometimes it's used as a negative sense. And most of the time it's used in a negative way. But there's a parable in Matthew 13 where leaven is used in a positive sense. So in these connotations of what we're looking at, it's something that you're supposed to eradicate for commemoration purposes. So here's a chart that gives an overall picture of these. Feast, and I'm going to say more about this next time as well. But the spring feast, Passover, unleavened bread, first fruits, all put together in 8 days. And then you got Pentecost, which is the ones that we looked at today. But like Passover, unleavened bread, first fruits, this would have been like their 4th of July. Like they get delivered from Egypt. Pentecost, you see how all of this looks forward to Jesus. You've got Jesus' death. On Passover, you've got Jesus' purity as the bread of life that doesn't have any leavening in it. You've got Jesus' resurrection on the first fruits on that Sunday. 50 days later, you've got Jesus pouring out the Spirit. You've got these references to these places here. And then, Lord willing, in 2 weeks, we'll talk about these feasts that take place, all of them in the 7th month. So, like, okay, that's a lot of information. What do we do with that today?
To me, it's evidence to believe the Bible is true, because it's like the Old Testament is so connected to the
I know, when you see, like, how carefully, like, how, did you guys realize that the first fruits that takes place during the week of unleavened bread, that when it's a wave offering, like, Jesus was the first fruits. He was the one that was waved up. He was the one that was resurrected. And he's fulfilling, like, the calendar of the Jews. It's so cool. But, so, like, part of this is, like, an evidence kind of perspective, right? That, like, God, like, look at how Jesus fulfilled all of this. What's the probability he could have done all of that?
So, I really believe that's what Jesus was saying in John 4, that we'll worship in spirit and truth.
Yes.
This is all shadow.
Yes.
What we are practicing now is the truth that was foreshadowed by all of that in the Old Testament.
And this is what Hebrews talks about, too, that we don't worship with the shadows, we worship with the real thing now. So, next time somebody says, hey, do you keep the Sabbath? Yes. I keep it better than you do. If you're just a Messianic Jew, I wouldn't say that. I might be thinking that, but I wouldn't say that to them. Unless they know that you can talk that way and they're going to get offended and all. You got to read the room, whatever. But I'm a northerner too, so anyways. But you keep it in its true form if you're a Christian. Because you have rest from your sin, and you have the true rest. And so, do we keep the Jewish feasts? Yeah, we keep them in their true form. We keep the Passover. We remember Jesus' death. We keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We get hypocrisy out of our lives, and we have false teaching out of our lives, all of these different sorts of things. We keep first fruits. We remember his resurrection every time we take the Lord's Supper. Passover, yeah. Jesus has poured out his Spirit, and we're still trying to learn from the things that the Spirit has poured out for us to learn from, and all these different sorts of things. So, and we'll show the parallels in the Autumn Feast as well. So, all right. I think that's a good place to end for today. Let's go ahead and pray. Sewell, can you pray for us?
Father, we're thankful for the wonderful wisdom that has gone into your planning for all mankind through all ages. And we're thankful, Father, for the new covenant under which we live, serve, and pray that we may be thoughtful of the implications of what we do in our relationship with you, which may not be as evident through miracles and visions as it was in the past, but yet is perceived by faith. We pray that our faith may be increased by such studies as this morning. And we ask your blessings on us now as we separate and as we endeavor to put into practice the things that are taught in your word that we've studied even this morning.